Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 11th of December. In a piece that will air today on PBS's Need to Know, Jamie Floyd, our first guest, writes the Supreme Court announced last week that it will decide two major cases that could have a sweeping effect on the rights of same-sex couples to wed. This is the first time the court will consider arguments for and against same-sex marriage. She goes on to outline what both of those cases are, how it all began in 2004 in California. And she writes that the battle for equality rages on across the country. If you look at this, it is amazing how quickly this issue is moving to the Supreme Court. Others will say it's not fast enough, but some will say this is rapid when it comes to civil rights legislation. Until 2004, gay couples could not marry anywhere. Now same-sex marriage is legal in Massachusetts, Connecticut, Iowa, Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, and Minnesota, but 36 states have statutes on the books affirmatively prohibiting gay marriage, including some that also have constitutional bans. We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour, Jamie Floyd, who wrote the aforementioned piece, an attorney, a broadcast journalist, and legal analyst for cable and network news. She is a frequent contributor to WNYC Radio. Later in the hour, Catherine Franke will join us, professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia University. You're welcome to join this conversation. Here is how you do so, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can always tweet us, and that's at K Dunn Show. Jamie Floyd, thank you very much for joining us. Hello. Hi, Jamie, are you there? Oh, wait a second. Jamie's on a different line. Forgive me. Hi, Jamie. Thanks so much for joining us.
I am here, and I just said what a pleasure it is to be here.
Thank you, and what a pleasure it is to have you with us. It has become, as you write, one of the most contentious issues of our time. It has also rapidly found its way to the Supreme Court. Are you surprised by how quickly this issue is moving?
Well, I appreciated what you said in your introduction. It is rapidly making its way to the court, and it seems like rapid movement for those of us who live in the world of constitutional jurisprudence, where everything moves at a snail's pace. But as a political matter, I appreciated your comment that it can't seem like it's moving fast enough for those who want gay marriage equality. So certainly those two positions are juxtaposed. After this last election, there have been polls that have been taken to suggest that there is tremendous support for gay marriage, indicating that a majority of Americans support allowing such unions. And after the elections last month, the number of states, just to update that information at the top, the number of states authorizing same-sex marriage increased by half to nine. So there is tremendous shift in public opinion, even though the law may be slower to adapt.
Mm-hmm. Jamie, outline the two cases that the Supreme Court decided to take. I know there were others there that they could have taken.
Yeah.
Why these two, and how significant are they?
Well, we never know why the court chooses to do what it does. We can only speculate. The case that they took that was less of a surprise, that we expected pretty much they would take, is the Defense of Marriage Act case, DOMA as it's known. That is the case that prohibits, under federal law, recognition of marriages in those states that permit gay marriage. So in other words, if you are married in a state that allows you to be married as a same-sex couple, you will still be denied federal benefits, Social Security benefits, for example, or in the case in question, a woman whose partner had died was forced to pay a huge amount of money. It was $368,000 in tax penalties that she would not have had to pay had she been married to a man, and she sued. And in federal court, the law was found to be unconstitutional, and this was the case in seven federal courts around the country. And when there is a finding that a law is unconstitutional, the Supreme Court is compelled to review that congressional law, and therefore the Supreme Court has taken the case. They chose to take a New York case, There were six other cases they might have taken. That is the federal law they are reviewing. They are also looking at Proposition 8, a now infamous ban on gay marriage in California. It started when Gavin Newsom, the mayor in California, famously, in San Francisco, California, famously opened the doors of City Hall to gay couples to come and get married. That led to a response on the part of voters in California to initiate a ban on marriage. The initiative was called Proposition 8, a ban on gay marriage, which did pass there. It was a close election, but it passed. And then there was a challenge to that, and that challenge has led to all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The question being, there are many legal questions. There's a question of standing. There is a question of whether it's just a state law matter. And then there's the larger constitutional question, can you have a ban on something that many believe is a right under our U.S. Constitution, the right to marry.
And going to the last part of what you just said, if the Supreme Court ruled on that, it would have national implications
That's
for gay marriage,
one.
Wouldn't it?
That is the big one. The court has many options in that case. I mean, they could reverse it altogether, leaving California's ban on same-sex marriage in place, saying simply that this is an issue of California law, a state's rights question. They could affirm it, what the court said. In other words, the higher court there in California said that indeed this is unconstitutional, and they could do that on a very narrow theory, which would allow same-sex marriage, but only in California, not requiring it in other states. Or, as you suggest, they could address the broader question of whether the Constitution requires states to allow such marriages, which would harken back, of course, to the Loving decision, the big decision in 1967, which said that you could not preclude people of different races from marrying.
Mm-hmm. And in that particular case, for historical reference, could the court have decided more narrowly? Was it a surprise that they struck down as unconstitutional all race-based restrictions?
In that case, it was a big surprise for two reasons. It came sooner than people expected, and it was a unanimous decision. And as we remember, those times were very contentious, 1967. And so, yes, but it was on very different grounds. That was an equal protect. That was a due process case. This would be an equal protection case, both very important constitutional principles, but a different principle is at play in this case.
Jamie, who's arguing this case?
Ah, you ask a very fun question indeed, and I know you ask it on purpose. Ted Olson, I know these two gentlemen personally.
Do you?
Yes, I do, because I covered the Bush v. Gore case, and I know that's what you're thinking of. They were on opposite sides of that case. Ted Olson, who worked in the G.W. Bush White House as Solicitor General, but also worked on that case, that infamous case between George Bush and Al Gore in the year 2000, and David Boies, who represented Al Gore in arguing that case that was ultimately decided in the U.S. Supreme Court, two of the finest lawyers in the country. And there is a very famous, famous picture now that is so worth looking for on the New York Times website of the two men, in fact, embracing in front of the U.S. flag, and it's a wonderful photo. And these are two men who really believe in our constitutional system of justice. So they've been fierce opponents in other matters, but ultimately believe in our system of justice, and it's a really wonderful thing to see them in court. And I've seen Ted Olson in the U.S. Supreme Court, and if anyone can grab the attention of these justices, it is Ted Olson.
We also want to introduce Professor Catherine Franke, Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia University. Catherine Franke, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Kathleen.
You have said, you've been quoted as saying that you are not thrilled about the Supreme Court taking up Proposition 8. I would have preferred they took the Windsor case alone. Why did you say that?
Well, I think most of the advocates in the lesbian and gay community who've been working on this issue for many, many years agree with me that they would have preferred that the court took a more incremental approach to the rights of same-sex couples to marry and situated that within a larger framework of what are the constitutional rights of gay people more generally. If you look at the process by which we won racial equality through the court. It was a very deliberate case-by-case building block strategy that the lawyers and the community activists took to finally get to the point of the court being willing and able to decide Brown versus Board of Education and then later Loving. And the advocates in the gay community have mirrored that strategy. And so the Windsor case was one that they put together, and it was part of a larger strategy to go circuit by circuit, picking very carefully the cases that would challenge the constitutional rights of gay people to marry. The Perry case, the Prop 8 case, was not a case that came out of the gay community. It was one that Boies and Olson filed and pushed quickly over the objections of the gay community.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So there's some concern that the issues that are raised, as Jamie noted, in the Perry case are different from the ones that are in the Windsor case, and that it may be too soon to ask the court to reach the ultimate question of whether there's a constitutional right for same-sex couples to marry. The Windsor case raises a different, in many ways, easier case or question for the court to decide, and the gay community lawyers felt that it was first important to reach the constitutional question at stake in Windsor and use that as the building block to later get to the ultimate question that is raised in the Prop 8 case.
Jamie, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I can't say that I disagree. Not only may it be too soon, and it is certainly the case that the Prop 8 Perry litigation is not a part of a larger strategy, but it also may be the wrong court. The Warren Court was a very different court than the court we have now, the Roberts Court. The Roberts Court is evolving. We have a second Obama term. Most people agree that President Obama will have at least one more and possibly, quite possibly, two more appointments on this court. And it's somewhat crass for lawyers like me to think so strategically about it, but that is what one has to do involved in big impact litigation. And now, if one is concerned about the future of the rights of gay people and gay marriage, you have to hold your breath, and it's very nerve-wracking to think what one justice, and really it probably will come down to Justice Kennedy, will do with the Prop 8 case. Now, sometimes we're very surprised in these cases, and it can be a different justice who rules a different way. But I am curious to hear what Kathleen thinks, but that's my sense of it, that it will come down to that swing vote, and that is really not the way these kinds of big impact, long-term civil rights kinds of cases should be worked.
Mm-hmm. Do you worry about that, just that swing vote, Kathleen?
Well, with this court, Justice Kennedy is the swing vote on almost every case.
Right.
Yeah.
We have a very polarized court, and so he's the one we're concerned about. He also is the one who wrote the Lawrence versus Texas decision from 2003 that found that there was a constitutional problem with having criminal sodomy laws. So that was the last huge gay rights case that came before the court, and not only did Justice Kennedy vote that the criminal sodomy statute was unconstitutional, he wrote the opinion for the court. So there's some sense that he may be on the gay rights side of the marriage question, but he's also Catholic and very traditional and very unpredictable in how he votes on a range of civil rights cases. Excuse me, he's not been all that progressive on race-based discrimination cases.
Mm-hmm.
He did write for the majority in a case called Romer versus Evans.
Mm-hmm.
And that case struck down a Colorado constitutional amendment that had banned the passage of law protecting gay men and lesbians. And Judge Reinhart, now I don't want to get too in the weeds on this, but Judge Reinhart, who is the judge in the Ninth Circuit, now we're on the Prop 8 case, wrote his opinion very, very narrowly to take into account Justice Kennedy's concerns in his opinion in Romer versus Evans. And I think, and Catherine, jump in if you agree with me, I think when Judge Reinhart was writing his opinion, he was writing it to avoid this case going up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and then if it did, to take into account what Justice Kennedy might do.
Well, I think all appellate judges write for Justice Kennedy. He's the only constitutional audience these days.
That's right.
It really doesn't matter the issue, but you're right. I do think Judge Reinhart was not only writing for Justice Kennedy, but also writing a fairly narrow opinion, because Judge Walker, who was the trial judge in the Perry case, wrote sort of a Tolstoyan,
yes,
vast, broad, sweeping homage to gay people and marriage.
Right.
In his opinion, at the trial level, that exceeded what was needed to do, what he needed to do in order to find Prop 8 unconstitutional. And I think the appellate court was trying to narrow that sweeping saga of the history of gay rights.
And also limit it to California.
Yeah.
Before we go to phone calls, let me just ask about this moment in time, this moment in history, considering the fact that public opinion has changed, so you have a majority of Americans believing that all Americans, regardless of sexual orientation, have a fundamental right to marry, considering what's happening in various states. Doesn't it weigh on all the justices that this is the moment, because of all of this, to take their decision and make it be a statement about same-sex marriage in this country, whether or not it's constitutional, whether or not same-sex people have a right to marry? This is the time.
Well, I think all of the justices want to be on the right side of history. None of them want to be the author of the next Plessy versus Ferguson,
mm-hmm,
that said that separate racial facilities, it doesn't violate the Constitution, separate but equal racial segregation is okay. On the other hand, the court doesn't really like to be the arbiter of difficult social issues that are still working themselves out in public opinion. And I have to say I agree with them about that. If ideally, this sort of issue should be resolved on a legislative level. It should be resolved state by state, where the majority of people in every state agree with the outcome, rather than having it something that is, and it's in the experience of those who oppose same-sex marriage, forced on them by five unelected judges. Now, sometimes we have to take that step, as we did with race discrimination, because we couldn't get those majorities, and there was a significant sense that the institution of racial segregation was immoral. But it would be my preference to move a little more slowly with this issue and bring along popular opinion so that we could change the laws state by state to allow same-sex couples to marry, so that people will have bought into the norm on their own through their own process.
And Catherine, do you see that as happening fairly rapidly, state by state?
It is. I think, as you noted at the top of the hour, this change in public opinion has been enormously quick, much faster than I ever imagined. 10 years ago, we didn't even think about marriage rights as something that was at the top of the gay rights agenda,
mm-hmm,
let alone achievable. So we have seen enormous change in the minds of those who were actually quite traditional on these issues. But it's important to remember, marriage is basically a very conservative political agenda.
Yes.
When the gay community is not asking for some radical reconfiguration of the institution of the family, they're asking to be participants in a very traditional institution. And I think that has something to do with the way in which the argument has become appealing to a broader base of people.
Mm-hmm. And Jamie?
I agree with Catherine that the court has traditionally been loath to wade into large social issues and make sweeping change. And the last time we did see it was back in the days of the Warren Court, although we do periodically have big decisions. It is important to note that just because there is a big constitutional moment in the court, public opinion does not necessarily follow. I mean, even with the major opinions, Brown versus Board and Loving and some other significant opinions of the civil rights era and legislation at the same time, commensurate with that, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, racial justice has been a long time coming, and we are still fighting that battle. And so that is why it is important, and I'm sure the justices are aware, that we not make sweeping change before the nation is ready for it. I do at the same time find it very interesting that the court took this DOMA case. Now, this is the Defense of Marriage Act case. There were several, as you pointed out, Kathleen, at the top of the hour, that they could have taken, and they were very careful to take one in which Justice Kagan could sit on the panel. There were some cases she would have had
to recuse
herself from. And they made certain to take the New York case, in which she can participate, so they will have a 9-justice panel, no possibility of a tie. And then they took the Proposition 9 case, which we've expressed our concerns about, but they took it. And it makes me wonder why. What is it that they have in mind? What are they thinking? What is their intention? Perhaps this is a moment where the court will be doing something big.
Ooh, what do you think, Catherine? That's interesting.
Well, as Jamie said earlier, we can only speculate about what the court's thinking. The decision to take the cases and the discussion about it is only among the 9 justices in a locked room, and that discussion is hermetically sealed in that room. So we don't know exactly what their reasoning is. There are a number of different ways they could go, and in taking both of them, but they also took them in interesting ways because in both cases, they added a special question into the case that hadn't been presented to the court by the advocates, and it has to do with the technical legal concept of standing, which means who has the right to bring these cases. In both of them, and this is very interesting, in both of these cases, whether it's defending Proposition 8 or defending the Defense of Marriage Act, the party that usually has to defend those statutes, the government, has said, we don't agree with the statutes, and we're not going to appear in court and defend them.
Oh.
Yes.
And normally when that happens, the case is over.
Mm-hmm.
The people bringing the challenge win because nobody's standing up on the other side to defend it. So in the federal case, the Congress put together a special group of advocates. They hired private lawyers to defend DOMA because the Obama administration wouldn't do it. And in the California context, it was the private proponents of Proposition 8 who stood in the shoes of the government to defend the case. And it raises really interesting questions of whether they're the proper parties to defend these statutes, or whether actually the statutes just fall because nobody is there to defend them.
One question before we go to phone calls, and I know Jamie will leave us, Catherine will stay with us for the full hour. I'm confused about all of these, and I guess there are some 1,100 spousal benefits that are not available to same-sex couples. This is the DOMA case. The benefits include waiver from the estate tax, collection of Social Security, filing a joint tax return, inclusion in federal employee health care plan, and on and on and on for 1,007 more or whatever it is. Will the DOMA decision be broad enough? Does it have to be broad enough that it will address all of these other benefits?
Well, it's very easy. They basically have to issue one sentence because DOMA this is just one provision of DOMA. There's several sections of DOMA, and this is just one of the parts of DOMA which says that for the purposes of federal law, all federal benefits, marriage is an institution between one woman and one man.
Yeah.
So anywhere that marriage is relevant under federal law, whether it's immigration rights or the tax code or Social Security, or, you know, one of the cases has to do with a federal employees who want to put their spouses, same-sex spouses, on their health plan.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get the same benefits if your spouse is the same sex as you. You have to have a spouse of a different sex. So the court can just say that discriminates on the basis of some prohibited quality about the person, characteristic, and that's the end of that. And then all of those people are entitled to federal benefits.
In many ways, the DOMA case, at least in my view, is a simpler case.
It is.
It's a clearer case. And even though I said that the court could do something big, that was sort of my hopeful law student self of 20 years ago speaking. You know, it's really, I think, unlikely the court would deliver such a sweeping ruling. And I wrote as much. I mean, I think really they could use the DOMA case to, which is Windsor, that's the Windsor case that Catherine referred to earlier, to narrowly decide whether the federal government has any legitimate interest in refusing to recognize gay couples in those states where gay marriage is legal. And then they can turn to the California case. And that's how the two cases would be related, and they'd be done with it. I'd like to think they take a bigger, bolder step, and that would explain why they took the two cases. But, you know, chances are, as we've suggested earlier, the court is a conservative institution, and they will probably issue the more conservative ruling.
Right. All right, let's pause for a moment. Jamie, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate your expertise. Thank you. We'll talk again, I think, down the road after the Supreme Court makes decisions here. Catherine is staying with us. Jamie Floyd, attorney, broadcast journalist, and legal analyst for Cable and Network News, frequent contributor to WNYC Radio. Our guest for most of the first half hour, beyond the first half hour. Professor Catherine Franke stays with us, professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia University. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm sorry to be late in going to phone calls, but these are somewhat complicated cases, and it's good to get a fairly deep understanding of what the Supreme Court is looking at before we start taking phone calls. All right? So, to you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, this is the anniversary of the death of soul legend Sam Cooke, and we're going to be celebrating his music and legacy. The author of You Send Me, The Life and Times of Sam Cooke will be our guest, hour two of the show. We continue now welcoming your phone calls about the Supreme Court agreeing to hear challenges to the Federal Defense of Marriage Act and California's Proposition 8 ban on same-sex marriage. We're looking at the intricacies of the cases and where we are in this moment in history and whether or not there should be a sweeping ruling. Would you prefer that, or do you agree that it should be more incrementally? That's what we're talking about. Let's start our calls with John in Harley. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Oh, good morning. See, my question was, other than gay marriage obviously isn't a federal law, are there any laws on the federal books that do grant equal rights to gay Americans?
Well, the Defense of Marriage Act that was passed in 1996 and signed by President Clinton made that impossible. In a sense, it outlawed any sort of recognition of same-sex couples. But if you're talking about rights of just single gay people more broadly, there's a statute in Congress now that's been considered year after year that would add sexual orientation-based protections to federal employment discrimination law. And we haven't had enough votes yet to pass that law, but we get a few more every year, and it'll come back up for a vote this year. But that's the most important pending law that deals with gay rights beyond the marriage issue.
Oh, okay. So right now there aren't any laws that give the same rights to those folks as, say, race or religion.
As a matter of federal statutory law, that's correct. There's no federal law that recognizes sexual orientation-based discrimination as similar to or giving the same protection, getting the same protections as race or sex or religion. That's right.
Thank you, John, very much for the call. Jean in Lake Geneva. Hi, Jean.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
So gender is kind of a squishy thing and a little bit flexible, is my understanding. So I know a couple that the husband and wife, male and female, were married for quite a long time. And the husband really was struggling with his transgender identity and went through a sex change operation and became a woman. And his life continued to be married to him, continued to love him, went through the whole process of this transition that is difficult, obviously. So his chromosomes are male, and his body is female. So does he get the protection? What happens?
That's an excellent question, and there are a number of other people in the same situation who've changed their sex during the period in which they were married. So their original marriage was valid, And really the issue becomes most pressing, I think, at the point of divorce. Unfortunately, that's when marriage laws become tested in most circumstances. Not to say that your friend's marriage will fail at some point, but that's when a court typically gets involved, is when there's a contested divorce of some sort. The court certainly couldn't hold that their marriage was invalid at the time they married, because they were people of a different sex at that point. But did it somehow become invalid when the husband became a wife? And no court yet has taken up one of those cases. And finding that same-sex couples can marry, whether we do it through the Supreme Court or we do it state by state, would solve the problem, because we don't care anymore who the sexes are of the people who are married. So not only will it resolve the question of gay people's right to marry, but it will also, in most cases, resolve the question of whether transgender people have valid or invalid marriages.
And so then I guess I ask the question, before you get married, do you have to have a chromosome test?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. We don't do that. I think most people would feel it was intrusive. Over time, we've eliminated more and more of the premarital testing that we used to do in order to find whether people were eligible. But it does raise a kind of similar question that was an issue until 1967, which is, how do you decide what a race a person is?
Right.
Yes.
Right. And in many, many cases, it's ambiguous. And, you know, most of us have mixed racial histories of some sort. And how would we test that, with a chromosome test or with some other test? So I think it raises the larger question, as you started out with your comment, that sex is squishy, and it does suggest, I think, some hard thinking about why do we care,
right,
what people's sexes are if they've decided they love one another and they've decided to pledge their lives to one another, just as we no longer care what people's races are if they love one another and they want to enter this.
Yeah. And, you know, I grew up a very very Republican, where government stays out of people's business. And boy, that's not the party that calls itself Republican now. So I really hope that goes back to stay out of people's business. Just, you know, keep us safe.
Well, I think what you've just said is really, really interesting, because it's not clear whether conservatives should oppose same-sex marriage rights, or at least the DOMA case, because it's really a states' rights case. It's a case where the federal government came in and said, we're not going to respect the marriage laws in 10 states in this country because we think we know better. And had this been some other issue, conservatives would have really objected to the federal government getting involved in what the states are doing. So, as you say, there's a sort of live and let live, get government out of our lives kind of value that runs through most conservative politics. And the DOMA case, the DOMA law, actually violates that basic conservative principle.
Thank you very much for an extraordinarily interesting call, Jean. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're talking this hour about the Supreme Court decision to hear challenges to the Federal Defense of Marriage Act and also California's Proposition 8 ban on same-sex marriage. Our guest, as you can tell, knows about the intricacies of this, and we're talking about it with you. If you'd like have any questions or comments about this, are you happy to see the Supreme Court taking this up now? Would you like them to see broadly? Would you rule broadly? Would you prefer that this be more incremental? We welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number. And you can always send a little email if you'd like. That's talk@wpr.org. Catherine, the National Organization for Marriage, the Brian Brown, the president of that organization, has told the New York Times, I am ecstatic. Taking both cases at the same time exposes the hypocrisy on the other side. Could you comment on that?
Well, that could be, just like we don't know what the Supreme Court's thinking, I don't know what Brian Brown is thinking necessarily. I think what he's hoping will happen, and he's certainly not wrong in thinking this is a possibility, is that the court took the Prop 8 case as a way to state that there is no constitutional right to marriage, that they could invalidate the Defense of Marriage Act, and we could win, we, the proponents of same-sex marriage, could win the DOMA case and lose the larger battle, which is the Prop 8 case. And that is, as I said earlier, why the advocates in the lesbian and gay community were hoping to have these cases come up separately, and Windsor going first, laying the groundwork for Prop 8. So we don't know why the justices took these two cases. They certainly didn't need to. They could have resolved one of the issues and then the other. But I think he's seeing a split down the middle, not only in the advocacy community on the other side, but also on the issues, and it could work as a victory for his side.
Mm-hmm.
if they rule for the gay advocates in Windsor and for his side in Prop 8.
Mm-hmm. In the same New York Times article, this quote, "The speed with which the court is moving has some gay rights advocates bracing for a split decision." Are you?
Well, it could split lots of different ways. The reason I mentioned the standing issue earlier, which I know is kind of a boring technical legal discussion, but it's really important because it gives the court an escape valve. If it turns out they can't get a majority or a majority that they like, they can actually get rid of both of the cases on the standing question and never get to the merits, never get to the ultimate question of whether these statutes discriminate against gay people or whether there's a fundamental right to marry. Now, law professors and people who litigate in this area think the standing issue is also extremely important, but most of Americans won't care that much. So it was an interesting thing that they added the standing question, and I wonder if that isn't a way for them to have an escape valve should the way that the arguments go and the justices' thinking go not be to the liking of enough of them.
Mm-hmm. John is next. Hi, John.
Good morning, Kathleen and guests. I have I feel that doing it incrementally is probably the safest if you're in favor of having the Supreme Court act on this in a favor. Anyway, I think putting all your eggs in one basket and betting on Kennedy's vote, I think that's just too risky. I believe that it's better, especially with Obama maybe having a chance to make even two appointments to the Supreme Court. That's how I look at it.
Well, John, I think many of us share your view that the incremental, perhaps political process is the wiser way to go. But we don't control how these issues move through the courts. As Jamie said earlier, the Supreme Court usually feels obliged to take a case where a federal statute has been found invalid, and that's not something we can control. But there's an interesting analogy here to the abortion cases. Justice Ginsburg was at Columbia at a symposium I held last spring, and she expressed the view to the group of us that she felt the Roe versus Wade case came too early, that part of why we're still battling out the abortion right now, so many years after that original decision was supposed to put the issue to bed, is that the public wasn't ready yet, that the case came too soon. And I kind of read between the lines that she might be saying the same thing about marriage, that it's just moved too quickly to the court and that the court risks getting out ahead of where the people are on this question.
Yeah, but darn the people sometimes. You know, you look at civil rights legislation and the number of people who died in this country and the incredible discrimination, and one could say that the gay community has suffered the same, and too many years go by with that kind of horrible discrimination, and we shouldn't let that much time go by.
Well, no one should have to die to defend their rights or to gain their rights. I certainly agree with that. But social change happens in a number of venues at the same time. The courts are only one of them. And we need to be working in our churches, in our schools, in our jobs, on the street, at the same time that our lawyers are in the courtrooms fighting to change public opinion and ultimately to change law. And I'm a little worried that we haven't quite accomplished the political work in the streets to make it possible for a legal opinion to come at the right time at this point. So as you said, there was a very active civil rights-based political movement in the streets and churches and schools everywhere at the time that the racial discrimination laws were changed. But we don't see the same thing happening in the marriage case now. And part of that is that the gay rights movement is led by lawyers. And it's sort of an ironic thing for me to say, since that's my job,
that's
making
you...
little lawyers.
Right.
Right, but I'm also an activist. I've always been an activist, and my work is both in the courts and in the streets. And I think there's a risk when a movement starts being led by lawyers that the kinds of issues that come on the agenda are the ones that lawyers pick out. And there are many people in the gay community that would never have put marriage at the top of the agenda. We might have thought about family security, but we thought about family much more broadly than just marriage. And some of the arguments in these cases have actually been somewhat biased towards people who don't marry,
mm-hmm.
people who don't want to or can't. And if there's any community in this country that knows what it means to have much more creative and flexible kinds of families than just marriage, it's the gay community.
Mm-hmm.
So putting all our eggs in the marriage basket is politically dangerous or risky as a legal strategy, as John said. But so, too, we in our community should be fighting for much larger or more diverse forms of family recognition than just marriage alone.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. I was reading some of the comments that were made in defense of the Defense of Marriage Act back in the 90s, and you read them today and you say, holy Toledo, did somebody really say that? How could they be so unenlightened? So I want to ask you, this political work that's been taking place in the streets, there obviously has been a lot of political work in the streets that has changed opinion, one would say, fairly rapidly. What's happened in the streets?
Well, you know, if nothing else, people are getting married. In Massachusetts, in New York, in Iowa, in New Hampshire, in Maryland, and, you know, all over the country. Same-sex couples are getting married. They're living their lives. They're sending their kids to school, and they're showing up at school as the parent and the spouse. And, you know, the world's not coming to an end. marriage, as we know it, has not somehow been destroyed, which is often the objection that those who oppose same-sex marriage have raised, is that this is going to ruin the institution of marriage. You know, my feeling is that the gay community has gotten too conservative, and then we're investing in a very traditional institution, and that we should be critiquing marriage. You know, I come out of the feminist movement of the 70s and 80s, where we had a very robust critique of marriage, and we understood it as not the best place for women. But the gay community isn't making those arguments anymore. We're making arguments about how we ought to be included in a very traditional institution. And don't worry, we won't wreck it for the rest of you. So it's a curious political moment. I agree that those same-sex couples who want to marry should be able to, and I think it's wrong that states prohibit them from marrying. But I do think our politics should have a much wider optic than just attaining marriage rights. There are plenty of us, both straight and gay, for whom marriage is not the right form for their relationship to take.
Catherine Franke is our guest this hour, professor of law, director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia University. More phone calls momentarily, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest, Catherine Franke, professor of law, director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia University. And we go to John, who's now living in Burlington, Vermont. We know John from his days in Wisconsin. Hello, John.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Catherine. Thank you for a great show. I was just calling in, obviously a topic I'm passionate about as a fellow LGBT activist, just to offer a counterpoint to something Catherine said about the push on the ground on the issue of marriage equality. It seemed to me as though she were suggesting that when the African-American civil rights cases were up before the Supreme Court, there has been a robust push in churches and in families and, you know, just on the ground level in the culture about, you know, African-American civil rights issues, and to suggest that there wasn't a similar push in the LGBT civil rights movement. And I would really have to strongly disagree with that. And I feel like the ultimate Exhibit A for my point would be the fact that, you know, in three states for the first time, marriage equality won at the ballot box last month. That's never happened before. Minnesota beat back a marriage discrimination amendment. That's never happened before. We've literally never won a popular vote before, and those victories cannot happen without the very robust conversation that Catherine said needs to happen. So I feel like that conversation is happening, and as somebody who is a part of those conversations, you know, I'd like to put that point out there that I think we're on the right track.
Catherine.
Oh, I completely agree with John. I think the elections in November were an amazing, signaled a kind of tipping point on this question. But again, they are the political process, not the legal process. And I'd love to have that process keep moving along through conversations that are taking place on a state level, such that we could perhaps reverse some of the prohibitions on marriage that have been enacted in a number of states around the country. 31 states have passed constitutional amendments prohibiting same-sex marriage. We could do it all in one swoop through a decision from the Supreme Court, or we could do it state-by-state retail the way that John's discussing. And ultimately, I'd prefer to do it in a more incremental way, but there are plenty of people who feel their rights can't wait. And their lives can't wait. Edie Windsor is an
yes.
elder. And so for her to wait until Congress gets around to repealing DOMA, it may be too late. So I understand that we have conflicting interests and conflicting strategies in the community. So I don't mean to say that we aren't doing the political work. I just like to keep it moving. And sometimes the legal work eclipses the political work that's happening on the ground.
Thank you, John, so much. Always a pleasure to hear from you. Deborah in Madison is next. Hi, Deborah.
This was more relevant a little bit earlier, but when we got into the discussion of the LGBT community, the other thing that struck me that I don't hear getting addressed, as a nurse, I have seen for over the last 45 years, a lot of children are born with ambivalent genitalia, and whether they are going to be considered boy or girl gets decided often in the first few days of life, back in the early days. Now, I think they've changed some of that. But again, when people want to think in concrete terms as to someone's sexuality and what it is that they need for happiness, I urge them to think again. It's not that simple. That's it.
Thank you, Deborah.
Well, Deborah, you're right. I think you're referring to something Jean said earlier about sex being squishy.
Right.
Not exactly a medical term, but I think that's what she was getting at. And her comment was addressing issues of transgender people. But the issues that intersex people face are incredibly important. And I think your comment raises the same question that we've been talking about this hour, which is, why do we care so much? Why are we so invested legally and socially in what a person's sex is that qualifies them as a kind of credential for citizenship or for participation in certain important social institutions like marriage? So, you know, when a baby is born, you know this better than I do since you're involved in this every day, the first question people ask is it a boy or a girl, right? And why do we ask that question? Why is that so important? I think part of this social movement is, in a way, getting at questioning that underlying investment in sex as a kind of social credential.
And why is it that we care so much? How do you answer that? We only have about 40 seconds for you to answer that, Catherine, but why is that?
Well, I know that's an enormously, it's a big question. There are cognitive scientists who, psychologists who have all sorts of interesting things to say about how people sex the person they're speaking to within a fraction of a second when they're talking to them. And if they can't sex that person, you know, figure out what sex they are, they almost can't hear them. They almost can't relate to them. If you think of the Saturday Night Live character Pat, there's a reason Pat's funny, is because we can't tell what sex Pat is. Right. Now, maybe this is all hardwired on some level that we can't change socially, but I think it's something that we invest in very much socially. It's not unrelated to questions of sexism that we deal with, even those people who aren't ambiguous or transgender.
Mm.
But the question you raise and the question Deborah raises are really fundamental and important and worth another show.
Oh, that's just what I was thinking. We're on the same wavelength. There's another show. And we were thinking about it before today's show, actually. Thank you so much, Catherine. You were a terrific guest. Thank you.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Catherine Franke, Professor of Law, Director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia University. We also thank Jamie Floyd, attorney, broadcast journalist, and legal analyst for Cable and Network News. And we thank Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program. And we thank you for all of your phone calls. We'll do follow-ups to this conversation in the not-too-distant future. Sam Cooke. We'll talk about his life and his music and play some of it coming up next hour.